and we are recording. So would you mind just, and we know who you are now, but would you mind just starting off telling us, you know, your name, like a one sentence description of like who you are and just today's date and time?
My name is Brianna A. Jenkins. I am 33 years old. I am from Baltimore. I currently live in Falls Church, Virginia, outside of Washington, D.C. I'm an attorney, a trans activist slash advocate. And today's date is April the 10th, 2022. It's a Sunday. I don't know what time it is because I put my phone in my purse and I put it on airplane mode. So
that's all right.
But it's probably, it's afternoon. Yeah, it's afternoon.
Yeah. And we are Sophia Lola and Caroline Srilly. We are conducting this interview and we are in our apartment right now, sipping on some tea and ready to talk. So, Caroline, do you want to get us started with the questions?
Sure. Yeah. And again, thank you so much for just being here. And yeah, we're just thrilled to talk to you.
Really, truly we are.
So both Sophia and I are from outside of Baltimore. Sophia from New York. I'm from Michigan. That took too long. So we're just kind of curious about your relationship with Baltimore and sort of how that shifted from like childhood to adulthood. Like, what that means to you?
Yeah, so me and my mom, I was raised primarily by my mom, single parent. We moved to Baltimore and when I was, like, in the third grade, and I'm 97. And I've been in Baltimore ever since. Baltimore is home. I love Baltimore. I went to City, class of 2006, Baltimore City College, high school. I also went to Morgan for undergrad, class of 2011. I also went to University of Baltimore. So I love Baltimore. I love where I'm from. I have so many good memories in Baltimore, so many not so good memories in Baltimore, but it's really the foundation of who I am, and I feel like there's no other people in the world, in the country, like people from Baltimore. It's just, we're just genuine, real people, real folks, hard working folks, and I love it here. I love it here, though I do not live here now. I never shy away from telling people where I'm from, and usually when I move somewhere else, people can tell that I have an accent and that I'm from somewhere. But yeah, I'm not ashamed of Baltimore. It really made me the person that I am today. I don't think I could. Technically, Baltimore is not the South. Well, technically, Baltimore is the South, even though people don't consider it the South. But it's a very Southern charm about Baltimore, and I couldn't have been raised anywhere else. So I love Baltimore. I really love Baltimore.
Thank you. You know, we're both, like, honored to just be here, even from inside the sort of bubble of our university.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, I feel so lucky to have come to the city. Thank you for that.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess we kind of, you know, as we told you in our prior conversation, like, sort of we want to focus on sort of recent Baltimore history and, like, queer and trans resistance in the city. So we're going to fast forward a little bit to more of, I guess, probably, like, your adult life or just sort of when you were a little bit older and more independent, and not focus so much on childhood. So I guess we were wondering, like, prior to 2015, prior to, like, Freddie Gray and Maya Hall, like, could you tell us, like, what your sense of the queer and trans communities in Baltimore were like and, like, what queer and trans resistance looked like to you and in the city?
Well, queer and trans communities, particularly Black queer and trans communities, they've always been in Baltimore, right? It's always been Black LGBT folks in Baltimore. And as far as resistance, I remember seeing quote-unquote people who were in activism or just using their identity to create awareness or to liberate others, mainly through like the HIV AIDS space. People who were LGBTQ folks who were health educators trying to fight back against HIV AIDS stigma. So, yeah, most of the people that I remember that were kind of on that wave or kind of had that radical politic were either working for the city and the health department, or they were working for one of the nonprofits here in Baltimore City, and that they were really using their positions to really create awareness around HIV and other STIs, because it's something that does affect the LGBTQ community in Baltimore disproportionately. So that was my first taste of activism, specifically from Black LGBTQ folks, and how I came into contact with a lot of folks, because I too, before Freddie Gray, my first really foray into community was through a position at a defunct organization now, Women Accepting Responsibility, where I was a health educator from 2011 to 2012. And I was able to directly interface with community and kind of resist in that way, providing community with education. But there were also intersections where some folks needed maybe legal services or like social work services. I remember us connecting specifically trans and gender nonconforming folks that wanted to change their names, connected them to like Maryland Volunteer Legal Services to get their name changed. But primarily it was for queer folks, it was through HIV AIDS prevention and education that I saw a lot of that kind of like that political activism pre Freddie Gray.
Cool. And that was like kind of right after you left college, or?
Yeah, so I finished Morgan like in 2000, like spring of 2011, and then I started my job at WAR in like October of that year.
Gotcha. And you said you stayed there for like a year or so?
Yeah, I left in August of 2012.
Yeah. Were there any reasons that you left, or like how did that work, like feel to you?
So, well, I quote unquote left, but I was forced out of my position. You know, there's something, and it's not even unique to that organization, where, in my opinion, I feel like people get grants and they get greedy and they don't do what they originally said that they were going to do. And particularly at that time, being a Black trans woman speaking out, it was kind of like the kiss of death. Mm-hmm. Because it was easy to push me out of the organization and then blackball me from trying to get jobs at other organizations. And that experience is not unique to me. There were so many Black trans women that came before me that had that same, because there was a lot of, particularly, this is before trans was like the hot thing and people were really inclusive of trans folks in like leadership spaces. Back then, it was if you were fortunate enough to work or to work for a nonprofit, it was very likely that you were going to be tokenized, and if you didn't fall in line, you were going to be pushed out and blackballed. And that was definitely, and it was like a cycle. So when they did that to one trans woman, they would go find another trans woman and give them the opportunity, but then they would set them on the same cycle, and then they would go find, and it would just create, at least in the trans community, it would create conflict amongst us, and we weren't really able to join together. Like, one, we weren't able to join together as friends because there's purposely being trust put into our community by outsiders to keep us separate. But then we're not able to politically mobilized because we don't, there's a breakdown in relationship already. Mm-hmm. So we're not able to come, we're not able to, one, warn the person that's going to come after us that's going to go through the same thing, but then we're not able to come together collectively and push back against all of these organizations and say, hey, if you're going to take this money to serve this population, then you have to do, you can no longer just take the money and run, so to say. Like you're saying that you're serving our community. Here are our list of demands. So, and I'm gonna be honest, when I got my college degree in 2011, I kind of thought that privilege was going to shield me from the trajectory of what happens to Black trans women, and it didn't, because it happened to me. So I was pushed out of that position, and I wasn't done with community per se, but I was done with just working in the community because of the trauma that I had and the fear that I had that I would be taken advantage of again. So I went, and it took me a couple of months, but I got a job at Walgreens stocking shelves for like $7 an hour with a college degree. I had just bought a new car at the time. I had car payments and rent payments. So it was a scary time, but I needed to take a job outside of the community just to show that I had value outside of my transness. And even though it wasn't the ideal job, it stabilized me and it kind of allowed me to heal my wounds in some way, to hold me over until I could like rebuild my life and like at a later point refocus on serving the like trans community again, but in a different way, and also in a way where I was leading and we as a community were leading, and we didn't really have any cis folks with their hand in the pot trying to tell us, you know, what was best for us.
That sounds like an incredibly painful experience. I mean, it's a rebuild yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it was hard. It was hard. It was embarrassing. Going from, because, you know, when I was working for the health education position, that was the most money I had ever made at that point. So to go from that and to lose that job in the way that they pushed me out on a lie, and like, and it's not just like a regular, it's like a job facing community, and, you know, just having like false narratives and kind of being blackballed and pushed out. It was very hurtful. But like I said, it wasn't unique to me, because I think of Sydney Kimbrough, who was an activist who kind of, I was under her tutelage and she trained me. She went through the same thing. I think of Lauren Stoeckling, Sandy Ross, just so many other Black trans women who kind of went through the same thing as me and ended up being jaded, doing people that really had heart for community, but because of the experience, it kind of jades them to doing the work and being in community, just because of the barriers that you will inevitably have to face trying to do the right thing.
Mm-hmm. So is that kind of like what you were doing, I guess, up until around like when you...
Yeah, so I was at Walgreens from like November of 2012 to... and at the time I was in Walgreens, that was when I was getting my master's at University of Baltimore. So I was there from 2012 of November to about April of 2014. And then, you know, Walgreens was great, but I knew I could do more. I know that there was more for me. So I took a job at Baltimore City Housing, like just working in one of their departments downtown in a building across from City Hall. And I took that job and I worked there from April of 2014 to August of 2016 when I left. So when the Freddie Gray and Maya Hall stuff had started happening, and when they had like the tanks and the protests and everything was shutting down, I could literally see City Hall like across the street from where I was working, and we, you know, I was in the middle of all of that. So,
yeah. Would you mind?
Yeah.
Would you mind telling us just, you know, a little bit more of like what it was like to experience the city, like, you know, during like the aftermath of Maya's and Freddie Gray's death, and just like during the uprising and with, you know, with like sort of the military and the police, like all here, like.
It was a lot of feelings. One, it was scary as hell, cause like going to work. Well, I remember like when the protests and stuff started happening. I remember us. They let us go to work. We went home early, and they were like, "Go home early," but and we had like a small window to go home because they were shutting down like bus service, train service. So you only had a certain amount of time to go home, and they were trying to shut it down so people wouldn't be able to travel from where they were to downtown to destroy anything. But it was scary. It was scary walking into work, and it's like army tanks lined up all down the harbor, and you're downtown and seeing like the military guys, and they had big. It was scary. And then our leadership at the time, Mayor Rawlins Blake, it was out of her hands at that point. She was just trying to save face, so we really didn't have any leadership from the people that were supposed to be leading. So it was scary, but it was also kind of exciting because it kind of felt like, you know, this is our moment. Like this is our moment to really inspire change. And even though it was scary, it was a little bit exciting. And also in the back of my head, Just seeing like the whole Black Lives Matter movement, just like how it has reoriented everything. In the back of my head, I was like, this is our time. This is our time as far as the trans community, as far as I was concerned, this is our time to really mobilize and come together and ask for what we need and to lean on each other. So I just knew that even in the fear, even in the uncertainty, that this was our time to strike as a community. And Maya Hall had just passed, and we knew summer was coming. And usually, you know, summer is triggering for trans folk, particularly Black trans folk, because that's typically when the murders of Black trans women tend to spike when it gets hot. So we knew, and Baltimore is no stranger to Black trans women being murdered due to violence. So it just felt like this was our time as a community to get information and to figure out, when we look back on this time, like, what shift do we want to, like, remember? What do we want to, you know, see happen? So, it was a lot of emotions, but mainly I was inspired, like, to do my part to kind of lay the groundwork so that, you know, now we can look back and we can actually see the benefits of, you know, everything that have happened since that time.
Was there, like, a moment where you felt that sort of, like, calling to this activism, or was it sort of building over time?
Well, I think it was building over time. So, okay. So, also, to keep this in context, I believe this 2015 is also kind of when Caitlyn Jenner first came out and made her announcement. And so, I was kind of, like, we were organized. What ended up happening, I can't remember that it was, so when I worked for the city, I wasn't like openly trans or anything, but like, I'm the type of person, if you know, you know, but I didn't really openly talk about my trans because one, I'm working with like other Black cishet people, and in Baltimore is a small town, like you just have to be careful, and I want to keep my job, and there's just a whole lot of factors. Because I was in community and people know me, they were like, oh, do this interview with the new... They wanted, like, real real people on the ground's perspectives about the Caitlyn Jenner interview and the and when Caitlyn did that interview revealing that she was trans, like, that was a big deal at the time. So I did the interview, and I was part of the interview thinking it wasn't going to be nothing. I think the interview came out on, it was like Friday night after the 2020 interview. When I came back into work that Monday morning, it was just like, I didn't, because it came on TV so late, I didn't think people would be watching TV. And then it's on a Friday night, like, everybody and their mama watched that interview. So I was just like, well, they know it's out. So, like, because I had this visibility and I didn't want to, like, the visibility, the Maya Hall thing, the Freddie Gray, it's like, how can I use this to, like, advocate for the things that I know we need in our community? So everything kind of, like, happening together. And then I was already in community with Monica, with Ava, Pippitone at the time, and with Kendra. I was already in community amongst them. So I was like, okay, yeah, the... And when the Baltimore Trans Alliance started, like, in spring of 2015, I was like, okay. And Monica, I think Monica and Ken were also in that interview. I was like, okay, this is our time to, like, use this visibility, like, use the momentum to really kick things off. And then it was right before Pride was happening. I'm like, okay, now we can use this momentum to really... get some things that we've been talking about for years that we wanted to see for our community. Now's the time that we can actually do it, and most importantly, lead it ourselves, because so many times trans leadership is undermined by cis folks, even cis gay folks who are in power, you know, undermined. So it was a complex of confluence of those things together.
What was it like to go from not being visible to suddenly so visible and so, like, and an advocate? That's such a major transition.
I mean, it was scary because, again, the job that I had wasn't, like, LGBT. It was, like, doing, like, housing and interpreting Baltimore City code. But, so I was always in fear, like, I could be... Even though we live in Baltimore City and we had protections and stuff, you know, that was something that I was fearful of. Are people going to treat me differently? And, but I also know that I wield a lot of privilege as somebody that has college degrees and that has been able to sit in spaces. You know, I wield a lot of privilege, so... part of that, with that comes the responsibility to advocate for people who, you know, need the access, need the voice, but can't get in those spaces. So I take the responsibility for owning the discomfort, owning the fearfulness, but I'm doing what needs to be done. So more of us can get into the spaces that we need to get the things that we need.
So how did, like, you and Monica and Ava and you said someone named Kendra?
Kendretsu. Kendretsu.
Got you. I guess how did you all and, like, whoever else was involved, like, how did you sort of, like, conceptualize and sort of make real, like, the idea for the Trans Alliance? And, like, what was that initial period after you guys sort of came together? Like, what was that like?
So I think we were, like, meeting, like, weekly or, like, bi-weekly, and they had, like, it was a community room in Chase Brexton. And this is when they first opened that new Chase Brexton building. So then, like, because it was so new, like, people weren't, I don't know if it's changed now, but back then it was so new that people weren't really acclimated to it. So we were just kind of, like, informally meeting every week. Then I think... the Maya Hall being murdered and then the momentum from the Caitlyn Jenner interview, I think we got to a point, it's like, well, we have to do something. Well, what can we do? And then also at the time, like, there was weird stuff going on with, like, the overall Pride organization. Like, I don't know if they were losing funding or something, but this was at the point where when Pride, like, the parade and stuff was still, like, in Mount Vernon. And I don't know. It was because of the gentrification that's happened in Mount Vernon. They were trying to push it like up here to Charlottesville. It was something going on. I can't remember clearly, but you know, and this is also the conversation of like kind of pushing back against gay ink and getting back to the roots of what Pride really was. And I was like, we have to do something at Pride to kind of disrupt this, like, oh, hey, like, let's have, like, granted we have fun, but, like, Baltimore's still, like, a majority black city. We have a very large black trans population and gender nonconforming population here, and we bear the brunt of every, so, yeah, we go to Pride, but we still have to live in the city. And where is, like, the strategic programming around, like, advocating for us on a real level and not just like having the mayor walk during a Pride parade to show her allegiance for, like, we need more than that. We need more than that. So we agreed that we would, and also Ava was working at Red Emma's, which was like at the corner of, I think that's Maryland and North Avenue. And like Red Emma's, like, there were a lot of, like, radical people there, and they had connections to the Why Not Lot. So, we just settled on the idea we were going to have a rally, start at the Why Not Lot, and then from there, it would turn into a march. We will march to, City Hall. I can't remember if we did the march that... I can't remember, so much has happened, but I remember us having, I can't remember if we marched, I believe, we did march, because it was high as hell, we did march, but we kind of had our rally at the Why Not Lot, and it was, I think it was, for it to be the first thing, a lot of people showed up, and it was surprising, and it was, we kind of had, like, an event, like, to, like, really recenter what Pride should be about, and that was like kind of like the first event that we had. Like, it was like the Friday of Pride to show people, like, hey, like, we're here. The movement is going to get bigger from here, and you're going to have to deal with us.
That's so cool.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. I guess I'm just kind of curious. More about that. Did you have another event like that, like the following year or just later on?
So from there and just the success of that and just everybody using their connections, I think we had a community meeting at Chase Brexton, another community meeting. And then I think the big thing to show people that we were serious is that we had a meeting with State's Attorney Marilyn Bowlesby. I think this was like the first, like, I think in 2015, that's when she first was in office. So in the state's attorneys before, they weren't really amenable to the LGBT community at all. Like, they were fiercely anti-black, but they were also outside. We didn't have a relationship. So it was very important. I think she like promised that she would be, you know, she would be more accessible. And she has a trans man that works in her, a black trans man who I was in community with that works in her office, Merrick Moise. And he was like, we're going to make this happen. So, and we didn't go, because there weren't any established procedures at the time at Chase Brexton, I didn't know that, like, when somebody high profile like that comes, like, to their, they want to kind of know, and at first they were going to cancel our event, and I'm like, do y'all really want to cancel this, and Marilyn Mosby supposed, because they kind of wanted to, like, be in on it, but I'm like, no, this is, like, see, this is not about, like, that capitalism, so this is not about that, like, let her come in, she has her security. But I think that event was like in September or October of 2015. We had the event. We had the conversation. I think I led the conversation, but it was packed. It was packed. And that really began a relationship with her office. And she's just always been super accessible to the community. And then from there, that's when we had our trans, March of Resilience weekend. So we kind of organized Well, I don't even think it was a weekend, but for Trans Day of Trans Day of Remembrance, it was part of like a national strategy to have trans marches of visibility across the country. So it was spearheaded by Milan Nicole Sherry out of New Orleans, Louisiana, who is currently part of the leadership team at House of Tulip. But there was a trans march of resilience in New Orleans. There was one in Ohio somewhere. Of course, there was ours in Baltimore. And it was some, I think it was one in Atlanta. They were like in different cities. It was strategically in different cities across the countries led by people of trans folks of color. But yeah, we had that event and like it was exponentially more people than the one we had in the summer because people, you know, knew about us and they wanted to support. And then I think Tyler had came a part of the second wave because Tyler was connected to Ava because I think Tyler used to go to like Red Emma's all the time and like Red Emma's was his own community. And yeah, and then I remember we were getting so big that the Baltimore police had got involved, which caused a lot of contention because, like, back even then, like, it was very, like, anti-police and the fact that they were reaching out to, like, they didn't reach out to us to stop us. They wanted to help us to make sure that we were safe. So, like, we were starting to gain more visibility, and that kind of, like, ended off our 2015 as far as like activist events and visibility events that we were doing.
Wow.
Yeah.
What was it like to have the police be part of that?
Yeah.
It was very hard. I remember they wanted us, I remember we, Monica, myself, and I think Ken had came. They wanted us to come down to, like, the main police station that's, like, off Fayette Street to meet with them to just tell them about. And, like, it was, like, I wasn't, like, I just remember being very, like, antagonistic towards them because it was, it still kind of felt like they were taking this as a joke, in my opinion. But, like, it was this weird contention because I wanted my people to be safe. I don't want nobody to get hit by the car. But, like, we're still resisting. And we're resisting how the police treats trans people when they're in custody. Arresting people, you know, basically abusing their power in many ways to keep their foot on our neck. So, it was... You know, that was interesting to navigate that. Ultimately, we had a very successful event, and we ended up marching to City Hall, where we had a rally. And then from City Hall, we ended up marching to, like, a church on where we could, like, once we had our call to action, you know, it was still important to recognize the people that we had lost, and you know, it was very emotional. But and also during that, I was sick that day. I didn't even think I was going to make the march because I was having bad stomach issues, and I had went to the ER the night before. But, like, the following month after the trans march of visibility, it turns out I had to have my gallbladder taken out. So, I was, like, physically sick, like, planning the event. And I remember I almost didn't go. I had Ava and Monica and the rest of, because we had planned so much that I trusted them to lead it. But, you know, the fight in me, I was like, no, I need to be a part of this. So, you know, I got out of my bed in pain and all, and... We did what we had to do, and that kind of set the tone where even if we don't do the march or do something, like, we have to do something on Trans Day of Visibility. Mm-hmm. We need to do something collectively as a community.
So was that all around sort of like the first year that the Trans Alliance was?
Yes.
Like, that was all around like 2015?
Yeah, 2015.
What, I guess sort of in that, like, beginning period and, like, that first year of it, like, what were you hoping to accomplish and, like, how did that change and how do you feel like, you know, things that happened?
What I was hoping to accomplish at that point, was to create a foundation. What I really wanted to do is I wanted to find somebody that was young and had more. Because even though I did that, you know, I was still kind of traumatized for the other thing, and I kind of was burnt out. So I was hoping to identify somebody that could carry the torch throughout that first year and a half. Like, it was like, even though Monica and can help me, you know, Monica is an elder in our community and she has other interests. Ken has a family, Ken has children. So, you know, he has stuff going on. So I kind of wanted it to connect, really connect with the youth, the trans youth, to kind of find somebody that was fiery, that had the passion, that just needed a little bit of direction and like the fine tuning that I had to kind of take the mantle and take, because I didn't know that even though what I was doing was great, I didn't want to do it forever, and I also didn't want to obligate myself to do it forever because I was connected to other trans women that have done it, and I'm connected with Black trans women nationally that do this work. I didn't want this to be all that I was. I still wanted to be able to step away and do other things and trust that somebody would be able to carry the torch. So, and I also knew I was going to law school. Like, that was the next logical step for me. So it was important for me to, like, really organize and get to know folks, because I knew that I was going to step down and I knew I need to find somebody that could continue the work. And it's enough work for all of us to continue. And ultimately, I did find that person, Ava, who was a part of who became my successor, I think ran the Baltimore Trans Alliance for like an additional year or two. And then she stepped down and passed the torch to someone else.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like you started this thing and you sort of knew from the get-go that this wasn't for forever.
Mm-hmm.
So when did you, I guess, step away? Like, when did you, like, more formally or officially kind of leave?
So I formally, like, stepped away in the end of July 2016. But, like, leading up to that time, my goal shifted to, three of my goals, trying to, like, find us a fiscal sponsor,
mm-hmm.
or, trying to find us a fiscal sponsor where we could have a relationship where we could use them until we got to the point where we could do the 501c3 stuff ourselves. Raising money to have, like, a little nest egg to give to, like, the new, like, ED and the new, like, team, so they could have it so we could do other events. Because by 2016, we were starting to get money, and I just wanted to save as much money so that, because, like, the events are not free, the permits and stuff are not free to have these events, so some of this stuff costs, so I wanted to leave them with enough money so that they could use it and build off of that. And then identifying somebody to take over. So those were kind of like the months preceding July 2016. That was kind of my time to really set up a transition process, mm-hmm. so that when I stepped away, it wasn't this abrupt thing, and that I really had somebody that could take the organization to the its next level.
Gotcha.
So, I guess just comparing the long-term goals that you had when you began, I'm curious just how, like, you've seen the development of it and, like, what you think about where it's at today.
Well, from what I know today, the Baltimore Trans Alliance is kind of, like, inactive. So, I guess, you know, there were some internal struggles within the organization. And because it had been, like, two or three iterations, like, people knew of me, but because by that time I was living in Chicago.
I wasn't
like coming back and forth to really build. And I also heard complaints primarily from the black trans woman that I was in community with, that the organization really wasn't serving or catering to black LGBTQ folks because it wasn't, the leadership wasn't reflected. Well, it wasn't reflected in the leadership, and it was kind of that racial disconnect. And by the time I came, I remember like my last year in law school, or my last semester, they had an event like a trans visibility like weekend convention, and they had it like at a hotel in downtown Baltimore. And I got like a recognition from the city, and I was able to meet the then exec ED or leader of Baltimore Trans Alliance, and they were telling me about some of the stuff. But I also met some black trans women that are leading their own organizations here. Like I don't know. Like, Aya kind of popped up, like, after I left or after I stepped down. But I am aware of Baltimore Safe Haven. And I think that, you know, that's a great thing. And I saw the publicity that they got when Gabrielle Union shared it. And she kind of went viral. But even though the Baltimore Trans Alliance is not... it's not around, or it's not active how it used to be. And it kind of makes me sad, because I did hope that it would still be around, and it would just be evolved and just in a different form. Still with the same heart that I started it with the same central mission, but like just even elevated. Though that I'm still sad, I am happy to see that, like, through organizations like Baltimore Safe Haven and just other things that the work that I did, the work that Monica did, the work that Ken did, the work that Ava did, and how the community came together during that time kind of paved the way to have places like that. Because I remember trying to have a house that specifically serves, like, black trans women. You could, even in 2015, like, that wasn't a possibility. It's been so many years where leaders that preceded me wanted to do something like that, but it was so much, it was so many obstacles, and not even the red tape, but just like the politics of keeping black trans people in their place in the city, that would have never happened. And the fact that Baltimore Safe Haven, they've had two locations, and they have relationships with local city government, and Mayor Scott, because I follow their Instagram, to see her have access, and even London DeRichelieu, who just got appointed to be to the mayor's cabinet for LGBTQ affairs. That, I think that's a direct, is directly impacted by the groundwork that was laid in 2015 to get folks to take our community seriously here in Baltimore City. So, though I'm sad that Baltimore Trans Alliance is not, you know, evolved, or, you know, not where I would have liked it to be, I am happy to see the strides that other black trans folks in the city. I'm also happy to see how the black gay men and women who've been in power have kind of been stepping aside and letting us do our thing, and not trying to thwart our efforts and undermine us. Because it's just really good to see the trans community on top. Now, I'm not sure about, like, the white trans community and how collective that they are, or I'm just not really sure about that. I'm sure there's community, and I'm sure, but the people that I see are mainly like the black trans women and men that I know that I'm in community with, that are kind of, you know, making moves and making strides, and I'm really proud of them.
Yeah, it sounds like your work has inspired incredible generations of activism.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Even if not in the way that, you know, you kind of originally planned, or in like the same kind of organization. That,
right.
Wow.
Yeah. I guess I'm just curious, just because of our topic, you mentioned that like white trans communities here and black trans communities are really just separate. Have they come into like clash at points, or has it just been just really isolated?
I don't think, like, the communities have per se come into a clash. What I have seen, especially when I was, working in this is even before Baltimore Trans Alliance. If it was, like, a program specifically targeted towards, like, servicing, like, the trans community or LGBTQ community, you could have a trans person like me that's college educated that could do the job. Or you have a lot of trans women who don't necessarily have college education but have life experience and could do the job. And what I've seen is they'll go get the white trans woman from, like, Montana or Utah and, like, fly them in and give them all the perks and the benefits to, like, run a program that directly, where they're directly interfacing with black trans people and, like, you know, the white savior, like, helping black trans people. And, like, black trans folks who are qualified get, you know, passed. So there's not necessarily a clash where the communities are clashing, but, you know, there is racism when, where, and racism, not even, like, white folks doing the racism, it's black people in power also contributing to making these decisions because they don't value, like, black trans leadership because they don't believe in us. I don't know, so since I moved from Baltimore, I don't know if it's the same now, but it was definitely a barrier to us being taken seriously and feeling like we didn't have the opportunities to advance, like, white trans folks are able to. It's and also and particularly you see, like, a lot of white trans masculine folks kind of, like, being the oppressor, you know, kind of being gatekeepers and in conflict with, like, a lot of black trans folks when it comes to getting access to resources and, like, kind of using their privilege to, like, just micromanage and not really create opportunities. So you do see, like, a lot of, like, institutional and, like, systemic, racism when it, comes to that. But, as far as, like, interpersonal clashes, because Baltimore is so segregated, in itself, you don't really see, like, places that you would see, like, black trans people congregating, you don't really see, like, white trans folks, congregating. I'm pretty sure, like, the white trans people that exist in the city kind of, you know, stay within their own areas. But there's, from what I've seen, it's just a lot of institutional, like, discrimination and bias and really not giving black trans, and which kind of precipitated why the Baltimore Trans Alliance in its original iteration, it was important for me to lead it. It was important for me to be the face of it. I knew that I could do the work, but I knew nobody else was going to really give me the chance to lead in a way that I know we needed to be led.
That makes a lot of sense. That sounds like a really uphill battle with solidarity.
Mm-hmm.
Caroline, do you want to kind of keep going down this path still for a bit, or do we want to maybe transition to?
Either way.
Is there, I guess, before we transition a little bit, like, is there anything else sort of about, like, your time really, like, with BTA and sort of in these, like, more grassroots activist circles? Like, is there anything else that you want to tell us about that before we kind of move into, like, law and law school?
So what I will say is while we were able to organize, like, on the trans front, part of something that didn't work out, which I kind of wanted it to work out, but I don't necessarily think it was my fault. I wanted us to be more connected to, like the overall anti-blackness movement that was happening, like the police brutality movement that was happening. But I feel like I was able to connect with like some people on an individual level that were leading that work, but like systemically, and we have to remember, like, during the first iteration of like the Black Lives Matter movement, especially at that time, it was very like black man centered, and we weren't having like the nuanced conversations like how we are now. Like how we need to like include all black people or like protect black women. So at that particular time, it was kind of, it was really like, we were really on our own because like a lot of like for instance, like leaders of A Beautiful Struggle, like they would extend the olive branch for us to come to their events, but they would never come to like our events. Like, mm-hmm. It was never reciprocated, and I was really trying to work hard to build that bridge because we needed their support. Like, we needed them just as much as they needed me to show up in those spaces to kind of build those bridges. I don't know if things are better now just because the language and the awareness, like in the like Black liberation movement, is popular to include like black feminist discourse and really you know, acknowledge that black men are getting murdered, but what about black women? And Me Too wasn't a thing yet, so we weren't talking about the experiences of black women and femmes like inside of these movements and just inside of black culture generally. So I would like to think that it shifted, but in 2015 I kind of still felt like I was dealing with like the transphobia and just like subtle anti-queer, which was also just another barrier. I mean, we still pushed through and there were like individual people, but as far as the collective, getting folks overall to see that they should have showed up for Maya Hall in the way that they showed up for Freddie Gray, it was very hard during that time. It really became trans folks organizing amongst each other and really pushing back, being radical. When I would make appearances, I'm not doing trans one-on-one stuff. We're not here to talk about that. A trans woman is that. I'm not here to give you a conversation about when I knew I was trans, and we're having a rally on Trans March of Resistance. Like, it's inappropriate, it's irrelevant, and you're proving my point by these. So yeah, it was hard. I'm pretty sure that there is awareness and a sensitivity now, but in 2015 it just wasn't there. Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. That makes sense.
That sounds like just frustrating and like disappointing to not sort of get that right solidarity in return.
Right. And I would imagine that it's better now, but like then it was like we were really starting from square one. Like when we started, we were really starting from square one. So the fact that we were able to do what we did with just like the lack of not only financial resources but social resources, you know, it was hard, but you know, we did what we needed to do.
Absolutely. I'm curious, just like where you guys met, because you mentioned like just this really core meeting starting. Where did you guys get together?
So physically we would meet whole court at Chase Braxton, but like how I met, so Monica, one of my like ex friends, who was a black trans woman from Baltimore, Monica was kind of like her trans mother, so I would like informally hear about who Monica was. And then the first time I saw Monica, they had like it was like 2010 or 2009. They had like this, Sydney Kimbrough had, or no, it wasn't her conversation. Somebody had organized like a trans conversation at Coppin State University. And that's when I first saw Monica. And then how me and Monica intimately became friends, and she kind of became like a guide, like a elder guide for me. We both worked at WAR together.
Mm-hmm.
So we were both working on the same grant together, and then She was also, she also got pushed out of the organization mm-hmm. the same time I did. So I remember when I was at that point where I was like, I can't work in community. Like, this was, I never want to experience this again. She was the person, like, encouraging me during the downtime. Like, you have this in you. You have to do this. And, like, whatever you need, I'm going to be by your side. So, she, you know, she was... And she just had a lot of wisdom. And she's able to approach stuff from a different way. So, she was just somebody that was encouraging me and kind of... And we were going to do... Like, during that time, we were going to do, like, some type of different activism organization. But that kind of, with my other friend, but, like, we kind of, like, stopped talking to each other. So, it just, so she was, Monica was just somebody that was always around who said that if I needed her to, you know, reach out. And we, and me and Monica would meet, we would informally meet, actually, at, it was, like, some building on top of the this LGBT bookstore on Chase Street. And we would, I remember us having meetings there at one time. But, yeah, I knew Monica. Monica is somebody that I just knew in community. Same with Ken. I can't remember exactly where I met Ken. But I just remember when we had community events, he would be there. And I, it was important to have, like, a trans masculine perspective, energy, like, I kind of wanted, like, the leadership team just to be, like, a diverse representation, just to make sure that we were including all different types of perspectives. And then Ava, I think I met Ava. So Ava.
Alrighty, we are recording again before this recorder so rudely cut us off and died. You were telling us about how you knew Ava, who was also one of the people who was sort of there as the Trans Alliance was starting.
Yeah, so Ava was the one I didn't have a personal relationship with, like, before the idea for the Baltimore Trans Alliance started. But Ava was just somebody that would just come to the meetings and that always wanted to be a part of the meetings. And also Ava worked at Red Emma's and was kind of like a manager. And when I would have meetings in Red Emma's, I would see Ava there all the time. So our relationship kind of formed and gelled just from us working together. And Ava was like the connection to, like, the just like the white community of people that she knew, and, like, the activist community. And because those people came through Red Emma's, Ava was able to spread the word and get the word out. But yeah, our relationship was, Ava was just dependable and reliable and just gave advice. Now, since then, Ava has detransitioned. I don't know if she's non-binary now. They go by Coda now. But back then, they were Ava. And Ava was just always there, always offering an idea, always, and just became, like, as we would get closer to events, just kind of became, like, my right hand. And that's why I felt comfortable passing the organ. And I also felt like Ava had room to grow, because at that point, Ava was still new into her transition at the time. So I just felt like her being in leadership. And also, she had a familiarity with the Black trans women. Like, she was able... And it was genuine. It wasn't a like a savior type of way. Like, she was really connected with Black trans folks and community, because mm-hmm. they too came through Red Emma. So she was able to, like, she was really able to be in community with them and really listen and hear them. So I trusted her to lead the organization, and that kind of, and to have the sensitive and the awareness that you need to run an organization like BTA was in a city like Baltimore is.
That makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's really just nice hearing about, like, how you've, like, actually met people, and also just, like, physically where you met.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So I guess we're also curious just how, like, with all of this experience and activism, and even just as you said, your first experiences at war, like how you made the decision to go into law and how that felt right.
Yeah.
I always felt like law was the next logical step for me. I knew I could use it as a tool to take my activism to the next level. And I was just, and also working at Baltimore Housing and just interpreting code and just advising people. Like, it made me curious, or it made me think that, okay, I could, you know, on a very, very, very basic level, like, I understand statutes and I can advise people into. Now, granted, law school is more complex than that, but I just felt like I could use this tool to advocate for a community that nobody is thinking about. So I kind of toyed with the idea, did I want to go to law school? And then my master's is in legal and ethical studies, which it helped prepare me for law school, but I didn't really need to get the degree. And so now that's even more student loans that I have to pay back. But I got to the point where it's like, okay, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to go all out. And also, I think I was ready to move away from Baltimore, because at that point, I think I left Baltimore when I was 26 or 25, like some mid-20s, and and people were just telling me, like, you know, Baltimore is great, but you need to move away and, you know, see the world, and then if you want to come back to Baltimore later in life, come and do that. But, like, I also felt like I was outgrowing Baltimore, so law school gave me the reason or the opportunity to go to a new place, a new city for a couple of years so I could really focus on myself. Because if I would have went to law school in Baltimore, I don't think I would have been able to, like, really zone in and focus the way that I needed to, so I could commit myself to, like, my studies and making new relationships. But law school was the next step for me, as far as my advocacy work.
What was law school like? What was Chicago like?
It was horrible. Moving to Chicago, even though I have incurred a lot of debt, and hopefully student loans will be canceled for everybody, but it's one of the best decisions that I ever made. Now, law school is hard. I'm just not going to lie to you. Like, law school is hard. It's like learning a new language. But the beautiful thing about law school is the how it forces you to kind of rely on people. And just the, so for me, undergrad, I didn't, like, live on campus. I lived at home. So I didn't really get to have, like, the real college experience where you're, like, making lifelong friends. And of law school, I haven't made friends that I will have them, like, for life, because you just struggle together. Like, you win together. You go through failures together. You're trying to figure it out together. And going to law school, like, I thought I was grown before I moved to Chicago, but it really grew me up. And though Chicago is a flawed city, it really gives you the opportunity as far as law. There's so many different types of law that you can get into. And I got to really try a lot and do a lot and stretch. And I really got to explore. And Chicago is, like, a great city to do that, because there's so many types of law, and so many law schools in the Chicagoland area. And I don't regret it. Now, I know I didn't want to stay in Chicago once I finished school, but I'm just very grateful for the years and my ups and downs that I had in Chicago, because it really was like a finishing school for me, just to, and just not in the law, but just how to deal with people and how to my own personal self-confidence, just being able to go into rooms where you know people are going to be against you, but just being able to hold your own and advocate for yourself and just hold your own. So I hated the process, but I love the fact that I don't ever have to think about law school anymore. But yeah, it was grueling, but you really have to have a good team around you, and it really shows you like who your friends are and the people that really support you and cheer you on. Gotcha.
Were you able to find any? I mean, it's law school, but were you able to find any like trans people of color also invested, or was that really kind of a?
Oh, so that was the sucky part. So when I came to law school, there was actually another Latinx trans woman that was in my class, but like she was stealth. So we knew each other existed, but she kind of didn't. She didn't want to be sister with me, which kind of, you know, it kind of hurt my feelings, because I'm like, we're both like, what is the odds that it's two trans folks in the same? And in law school, they split you up into different sections. So she wasn't in my section, but we knew of each other. But, you know, she kind of just did her thing, and I did my thing. But as far as other black trans women, no. Like, and that was the sucky part. And, you know, that's kind of the sucky part in my career, because it's only one other black trans woman that I know that's practicing. Not to say that there aren't more out there, but as far as like out and visible, I haven't seen a lot. And you know, it can be isolating, because you have a lot of people try to give you like career advice or information, and you know, a lot of that stuff is great, but a lot of it is not applicable to me and the path that I have to walk and the things that I have to stand for. You're going to have a lot of people give you advice that, while it's a well-intentioned, you're not going to be able to apply it, because nobody has really done what I'm trying to do. And, you know, it's going to be hard. And, you know, there was another trans woman, so... when I came in my first year, there was a white trans woman who was a 3L, and she was leaving out. And I was happy to have her there. She was a support. Lark is her name. And she was just inspiring, because she was like first in her class, and she was just like freakishly great at law school. And I knew I was never going to be smart like her, but it was just inspiring to see that, you know, there was a trans woman there, and like she not only did law school, she is mastering law school, and she just moved out of the country. She doesn't even practice law anymore. She like found a job in Mexico and is like living somewhere in Mexico. but yeah, it's not. It's more trans masculine folks that are, you know, going through law school. But as far as like trans women, especially trans black women, I'm hoping there's more after me. Like, it's a black trans woman that I mentor who's in law school right now. But yeah, it's hard. It's hard, and you really have to. And I tell that to anybody that's coming to me for law school and they're trans. It's like, you know, are you really ready to deal with that? Do you have access to mental health? Or because, you know, it's going to get to you. It's going to get to you, and you have to figure out positive ways for you to deal with it, so you can do your best in law school, because you still want to try to get the best grades that you can, so you can so it can be that easier for you to like find a job and be competitive. But yeah, it's hard, because law school is designed for white men, for white straight men. And the closer you are for that, the easier it's going to be. Even if you were a sucky student, that's just the name of the game. And, you know, I just try to be realistic. I'm not saying don't do it, but you really have to be prepared. And I walked in green. I thought we were all going to be friends, and everybody was genuinely. And after that first week, I was like, okay, we're really doing this. What did I do? If I leave now, how much money will I owe, or do I have to pay back? Because Yeah. Law school is hard, and it's slow to become more diverse. Very slow. Like, the Black Lives Matter has, you know, really sped stuff up with, like, diversity, equity, and inclusion. But, you know, it's a lot of progress that can be made. Yeah. A lot.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah. In your, like, current practice, how did it feel just kind of carving out, like, a queer space in a field that doesn't have it, really?
Well, I just started a new job on Monday, so I'm...
Oh, wow.
I'm a staff attorney at Transgender Legal Defense and Education Fund, so... I don't really have to carve out a space since I work at a trans organization, and we're my passion is my work. So basically I'm helping people getting name changes in states that have barriers. I'm strategizing with people how to sue these states so we can remove these barriers. So mostly everybody on the staff is a trans identified person. I've been wanting to be open with people. People are, you know, how are you doing? I want to meet with you. I want to talk with you. And one of the reasons that I left my firm, while I was making the most money that I've ever made, I wasn't happy with the work, and it was isolating. I was the only Black person working in my department. I was the only out trans person as far as I knew of, and there wasn't really a lot of space for me to be me. And I remember Black History Month came, and we didn't even get like an email like acknowledging Black History Month, and I'm like, okay, it's time for me to go, because I need to be somewhere where I can be all parts of myself and I can get to know people. And I just didn't feel like it was a space for me to do that. And, like, the beautiful part about being a lawyer is that people hop from job to job all the time. Like, that's kind of, it kind of comes with the profession. So, I gave myself permission to look and to be at an organization where I could be myself and, follow my pursuits and just marry them together. And I really believe in the organization. I believe in the work that we're doing. And it's just great to come to work and to be myself. And, that's the great part about being a lawyer is that it's at will. So if I don't like it, I could sit there and, make the place a more, but, all this money, these people, like, y'all should already be doing it. Y'all should already be, take the time to invest, to make sure that your place is diverse so you won't have to lose money by having these people that you're training just up and quit because they're not happy. Because, like, just because you pay somebody a lot of money, that's not enough to keep somebody at a job if they're miserable.
Yeah.
You have a high enough skill set and they have enough money that you don't need to be tokenized.
Right.
Yeah, truly.
Right.
Well, it sounds like you've moved on to something better, and I hope it only continues to get better. Do you have any other kind of questions about the law? Because there's something else that I feel like has come up a few times that I would love to sort of ask about too.
Oh, go for it. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess as you've sort of been talking a little bit about Monica and like your relationship with her and like how she kind of guided you and how, you said that you hope that like there would be other sort of like Black trans women who would also go to law school and like sort of follow what you did. And I think, did you say that there was like someone who you know who's currently in law school?
Mm-hmm.
I guess, yeah, it sounds sort of like there's like this idea of like mentorship and like almost like generations of like support and like guidance, mm-hmm. and like passing down like community. And I guess I was wondering if you could just speak more about that and what that's been like for you and how you may try to like be a mentor to people.
Well, as far as it comes to like Black trans women, like I'm just in community with Black trans women, like period. Like most of my close friends are other Black trans women. I'm just always in. Now that doesn't mean that I'm friends with everybody, but like for most of the people that I'm close to are Black trans women. But and I, it's just something that I'm very intentional, and it kind of has to be that way because not only for love and building community, but for safety, just for us to check on each other, just with them, just, you know, I need to be talking to folks on a regular basis. They need to hear from me, especially with our elders, just checking on them. Because trans women, we tend to, especially Black trans women, we tend to live, like, single lives. We tend to, and it's very easy to be isolated and not in community because you might be in a situation where people are disowned from their families, so they don't necessarily have, you know, the strongest family connections. We might not necessarily have the strongest romantic situation. So a lot of time, and especially as you age, it's likely that you might be on your own. So for me, it's been important to just foster those connections and just to be in, like, constant communication with people and to just be checking in on folks just for love and for safety and just so it's something that I always do. I have had people in community reach out to me about law school. I'm very if you're serious about it, I'm very open about, I'm very generous with my time, and I'm talking to people, and I'm giving people tips, and I'm giving people advice. So, you know, I make myself available. I'm not a person that believes in hiding the ball. I'm going to give you the information. It's up to you to take it or to utilize it. But yeah, I have a like my trans daughter who lived here for a period of time, and she's back in Georgia, and we're rebuilding. We weren't talking for a while, but we are rebuilding our relationship. So I'm just a community person. Like, I'm just somebody that I have my ear to the community. Like, I know what's going on. Because if I'm in a position where, like, I'm advocating or I can't speak and not be a part of the community, because then that could easily turn into me, like, being an opportunist or exploiting people. And that's just not, what I'm about. But, I'm all about building community, like, on an activism level, but, eventually your politics should leak into your personal life by who you're choosing to surround yourself with and share your love with. And I love my community because I love myself. And and again, if somebody wants mentorship, like, I'm at the point where I don't have kids yet, so, like, you're not my child. I'm going to give you the information. It's your life to live. You do what you want to do and do what you need to do. But I'm gonna tell you what I did. I'm gonna tell you what was successful. I'm gonna tell you what I failed at, and, you know, do what you need to do with the information that I give you. But I just believe sharing information, it just keeps us informed and it keeps us safe. And I'm the utmost importance, I'm all about Black trans folks leading long, healthy, and productive lives. You know, that's what I want for us.
Yeah. Thank you. That sounds just, like, a really nice, like, strong and, like, beautiful sense of, like, relationships and, like, maybe even kind of family.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you. That was, yeah, that was just very touching.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you want to go from here?
I guess, I think you said a lot about that just now, but I'm curious, as you're moving forward, what brings you hope in your work and for just the future?
I think one thing that brings me hope is there is a shift happening. Again, just seeing how now people respond to transness and topics on transness, I think it shows that the work that, and not just me that I've done, like, not even keeping this to, like, Baltimore City, but the work that we've done as a community, like, across the world and the country, that it is starting to shift. It, like, people know the language now. people know the language. People know what's offensive now. People, for the most part, people know what not to say, or they know to have that pause or that question of themselves. So, and I think a lot of that has to do with like social media and just the way that we're able to disseminate information faster, and how everybody is kind of getting the information at the same time. You know, that gives me hope. Seeing more trans folks in leadership and just doing more, that gives me hope, because not that long ago, like it was hard to just get opportunities to lead our own movements, to be taken seriously. You know, seeing Zaya Wade, like seeing a child being like loved and embraced by their family for being trans, like that lets me know that the conversations that we're having, the awareness that we're creating, that everything has not been in vain, and also that we have so much farther to go. Like when we're able to, it's not when the celebrities are doing it, which is a powerful thing, and I don't want to discount that, but when people are able to replicate that in their own homes, in their own families, the fact that we have folks, cis people, questioning their gender and, you know, exploring their identities and feeling free to, like, openly talk about these things, I think that's great. I think for me, on a personal level, I'm excited about aging and living longer. Like, when I was young, just in my transition, I didn't think I was going to live a long time, because it's, like, most of the black trans women I know, like, they just died young. They were either murdered or they died from health reasons. So I didn't really, you know, if the future came, it was nice, but I didn't really want to plan for my future, because I didn't know if my depression was going to take me out, just because, you know, I wasn't, you know, I didn't have access to, like, to mental health and to medication or all of that. So, you know, I thought one of three things were going to take me out, but just, as I've been able to personally ascend and just have a better quality of life, like I just want to be here. I want to live longer. I just want to be open to, like, really living life, doing things, just doing new things, being here, trying to be a beacon of light and support, like, just for my family, and friends, and just the lust for life that I didn't have, because I just thought that as a black trans woman, there were only certain things that I could do, and I couldn't do anything else. And I just think that the times that we're living in, and just the slight advancements that we made and the freedoms that we have, like, you know, I want to live long. I don't want to do, like, activism for the generations that come after me. Like, I want to be able to, I'm fighting so hard so I can experience some of those benefits now. Because I feel like we did, and I got that quote from somewhere, I didn't come up with that, but, like, I want to be able to experience some of that stuff now. I don't want to have to die. And not to shade the younger generation, but, like, I deserve to feel some of that love too. So, I'm really just trying to, like, prepare for the future, and, you know, taking the moment, and just to be here, and also to one day step away from this work and to do something else if I want to do, you know, and that comes from just training leaders and then letting them lead their own way, even if your organization just folds. Like, you know, I could have, you know, with Baltimore Trans Alliance, I could have, you know, stepped back into the reins and, you know, let it just to serve my own ego, but my heart wasn't in it. And you just have to let the chips fall where they may. And just know that what is for you, like, what you're being called to do, like, is going to take you ultimately to where you need to be.
That's beautiful. I love that.
Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
I love that there are so many things to be hopeful for in so many directions. It's just even in our class, and just obviously as queer people, we've been talking just a lot about, like, joy and
yeah.
It's some, just really wonderful to, mm-hmm. yeah, to no, hear that.
It's definitely something that we wanted to, I think joy is something that we wanted to, like, be able to bring in as much as possible, because I feel like it's so easy for people to look at, like, particularly, like, Baltimore and, like, the Baltimore community, like, and just see, like, struggle or pain or whatever, and that's right. not... Like, that's not true.
Right.
And, like, they're... Yeah.
And even, like, before, like, we had all... Like, I feel sorry... Like, even though it's easier to, like, be queer or to be trans now, and it's great because it's a testament to, you know, all of the work and the sacrifices we made, like... When I was coming up, like, being, like, trans or being queer, it was fun. Like, it was, like, now there are no, like, social spaces for us to go to because they've closed everything. Mm-hmm. Back when I was, like, that's why I don't think I could move back to Baltimore now, because everything that is near to me that I loved about Baltimore is gone.
Mm-hmm.
They've, you know, closed it. It's not here. And, like, it was fun being queer here. And this was, like, we still had internet in my time. Clearly, we didn't have we didn't have smartphones, but we had websites. But even the internet, the way we used the internet in the 2000s, it's a nostalgia about certain sites that we went to and just how we had to create community amongst each other when we weren't supposed to be doing that. But we still found each other and we still have these memories. Like, so even back then when, you know, it was the worst of times, like, we still had joy. We had community. Maybe it's not, we weren't organized, but we still knew who we were. We still knew that we existed. So, I'm even though things are better now and I'm thankful for that, there are times where I miss, you know, old Baltimore and just how carefree. And then I didn't have as many responsibilities. I was just, you know, carefree running around. But we had joy then too. We, you know, we made the best of it. We really did.
Yeah. I love that. Just like confidence and like love and youth.
Mm-hmm. No, and just here's hoping that there's only more joy to come.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I guess, is there anything in here that we haven't captured yet or that you wanted us to ask about?
No, I think y'all got everything. Yeah, I think y'all got everything.
Awesome. Great. Well, that was just... We came in to this, I think, already with, like, high hopes and high expectations, because just what we had heard about you, we were like, we're going to get some good stuff, we think, and this has just, like, surpassed even those high hopes. So, thank you, and I guess with that, we will end our recording.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I also recognize we fully took